Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 to 13. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come down, come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have, so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.
Poor little Pingu. Excluded from badminton, I think he was left out of the fish as well. But there are varying degrees of exclusion, aren't there? So I'm sure we've all felt the Pingu-like exclusion back in the schoolyard, picked last for one of the football teams or something like that. And that hurts at the time, but we get over it, don't we? But what about if there's a party or a social event such as a wedding? I'm sure my invitation's in the post any day now, and then it never comes. Well, that hurts a little bit more. And some of us have had Freshers Week recently. What about as the week progressed, you started to see friendship groups forming, you're seeing cliques emerging, and you realise that you're on the outside of all those groups? Well, that hurts a whole lot. And even more seriously, imagine if after a busy week in the cut and thrust of London life, you thought, well, I'm away from my family, I'm feeling really down, but at least I get to come to Euston Church, a place where I feel welcome, a place where I feel at home, I can rest. And as you come to the door there, the red t-shirt mafia, they stop you and they say, no, you're not welcome. He can come in, she can come in, but not you. Well, that's really serious, isn't it? And that is the level of exclusion that the Philadelphians, which we've read about in our passage today, that was their 24-hour, 7-day-a-week experience. And they weren't excluded because they weren't cool enough or weren't in the right friendship groups. They were excluded because they were Christians. Here we're looking at letter number 6 out of 7 from King Jesus to the Christian churches in modern-day Turkey. If ever there was royal mail, these letters are it. And in the first instance, this letter is sealed for the Philadelphian church. But Jesus' Spirit, he grants us permission to steam it open, to eavesdrop on that church. You can see that in verse 13. It's a repeated refrain we've had every week so far. He says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says. And so if your ears aren't painted on, Jesus says, listen up. This letter to Philadelphia, it's similar to the one that Kev showed us to the church in Smyrna in chapter 2. You see, both Philadelphia and Smyrna are the only two of the seven churches to which Jesus has nothing bad to say. And both churches are suffering for their faith in the gospel. It seems that suffering is a regular part of the Christian experience. But I think the nature of the Philadelphian suffering is exclusion. And each of these letters begins with a description of Jesus that gives us a clue as to what's going on inside each particular church. So have a look at verse 7. He says, and to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one shuts, who shuts and no one opens. Philadelphia is reminded that Jesus is the one who holds the key of David. We've seen Jesus in chapter 1, he holds the keys of death and Hades, but now he holds the keys of David. And that's a reference to Isaiah 22, to one who holds a key to a door that no one's able to open. You see, in the Old Testament, King David was promised an eternal kingdom from his line. In fact, the whole thrust of the Jewish religion was to be included in David's kingdom. And so when Jesus says to Philadelphia, "I hold the keys of David," he's saying, "I control the entry into David's eternal kingdom." And I think this keys and door imagery is really important. I think it hints to us that the heart of the Philadelphian persecution is exclusion. Or, in other words, having doors shut in their faces by the religious Jewish authority of the day. And the tragic irony for the Jewish authority of the day is while they quite literally controlled entry into God's house, the temple and the synagogues, they rejected God's Christ as their king. This may have been part of a Jewish effort to segregate out between Christians and Jews, to separate out between the churches and the synagogues, making it really clear that Christianity is not some offshoot of Judaism. It's not some Jewish sect. It's a form of prehistoric apartheid. Those Christians are not with us, and we are not with them. And I think what that looks like on the ground was the Jewish community excluding the Christians from the synagogues and temples, places where the Christians could worship. And in those days, religious life wasn't limited to the Sabbath. It spilled over into every other aspect of life, into Mondays to Fridays, into business life and social lives. Acts 19 and 20 talks about the church in Ephesus. We've seen them already in Revelation. In Ephesus, every aspect of life, not just religious life, but every other aspect of life was dominated by the religion of the day. And so, for our Philadelphians, exclusion isn't limited to a religious exclusion on a Sabbath, but actually cut out of every aspect of mainstream life, from Monday through Saturday as well. And so would the Philadelphian Christians have had a better Freshers Week if they weren't Christians? Would the Philadelphian Christians have progressed further in business or their careers if they didn't have so many doors shut on them because of their Christian faith? And so to his Philadelphian church, Jesus says, "I actually control the keys and the door to the only entry that matters, to my Father's kingdom." The other repeated entry we see in this letter, which we've seen right through the churches in Revelation, is verse 8. "I know your works." Jesus is saying, I know you, I've studied you. I'm like a doctor, I've diagnosed you. And here is my verdict, halfway through verse 8. "I know that you have but little power. I know that you have faithfully endured, that you have kept my word, not denied my name to the point of your exclusion. But it has left you on your knees with very little power." When I read about this little Philadelphian church with little power, I'm reminded about another famous Philadelphian with little power, Rocky Balboa. I remember Rocky Balboa, small little guy, little power against Ivan Drago, the big, tall Russian, full of power in Rocky IV. No? I should have remembered that we did a straw poll a few weeks ago, didn't we? And we found out that most of you were born in the 1990s, but there you go. To put it another way, the Philadelphians were like a car which has done many, many miles. They're running so low on petrol that their little orange fuel light is on. You ever driven a car like that? Will we make it to the next petrol station? But Jesus knows that. He knows all of the miles and miles of faithful endurance in spite of exclusion. And so in this royal mail from Jesus, he wants to fuel their tanks up again. He wants to strengthen them. And some of us may not be feeling the pain of exclusion right now at that Philadelphian level. But I think this passage in verse 8 makes a link between exclusion and holding fast to Jesus' words. If you keep holding fast to his words, you can expect that Philadelphian level of exclusion. And I think exclusion these days takes many forms. So there's religious exclusion. Some of our international students will be going back home to countries where Christianity and this Western freedom is not the ideology of the day. What about intellectual exclusion? Some of us work in industries such as science or education, where Christian thought is completely shunned and rejected and puts you right on the outside. And there's also family exclusion. One of my best friends in England, his family, he became a Christian at university, and his family found out, and they have basically rejected him. They don't want to have anything to do with him. They don't want to talk to him about Jesus. His siblings really hate him because he's become a Christian. And so if you're not feeling the pain at that Philadelphian level just yet, now is the perfect time to prepare yourself. And I think the reason for that is there's something about suffering that is so overwhelming and so, I guess, visceral that we can't see clearly through it. We're not able to think our way around it when we're blinded by our own pain. And so if you're not feeling the pain of exclusion at that Philadelphian level, now is the perfect time to prepare. And so I've got 5 points on your handout. Here's a tip. If ever you're writing a sermon, don't put 5 points on your handout. Kev even rung me in the middle of the week to tell me I have too many points on my handout. But in my defence, I think the way this passage works is a wave after wave after wave of encouragement from Jesus to a church that's on its knees. And so there you go, Kev. But I'm going to combine points 4 and 5 just for the interest of time. But here we go. Encouragement number 1. Jesus jams open the door to life. Verse 8. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. As we saw from verse 7 just before, Jesus says, while you've had the doors to the synagogues and a trouble-free life shut in your face, I control the only door that matters. But here in verse 8, he adds to it. He says, behold, I have jammed it open for you. And I've used my door stopper. And unlike earthly doors, no one is able to open my door. One of my most prized possessions in life is a door stopper. There you go. I made it when I was in year 8. That's 1990. It's nearly 25 years old, and I've brought it with me. Here it is. There you go. This is one of my most prized possessions in life. My wife thinks it's the ugliest thing ever. Personally, I think the craftsmanship is undeniable. But there you go. She didn't want it in the house, but I told her that the door stopper and I are a package deal. But there you go. Imagine, well, that's my door stopper, but imagine what Jesus' door stopper is like. Can you imagine how heavy his door would be? When he jams his door stopper in his door, how open does that stay? And I think this is really important to know, because when you're suffering, you don't want to hear that God is as low on fuel as you are. You want to hear that God's in charge of your present, in charge of your future. And he has door stopped and locked and jammed the only door that really matters wide open for you. And so, for the Christian in the workplace, maybe you can look back at over the years all the ways to which career progression, the doors were shut on you, to which advancement in business, you had those doors closed because of your Christian faith. Jesus looks at you and he says, I know. And he says, I control the only door that really matters. Let's have a look at encouragement number 2. The slander will be silenced. This is my favourite of all the encouragements. He says, verse 9, behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. When we looked at the church in Smyrna back in chapter 2, we learnt that their persecution involved slander, that is, people spreading lies and saying venomous things about you. And in the church in Smyrna, we also met those of the synagogue of Satan. They pop up here again in Philadelphia. I think most likely Jesus is referring to religious Jews of the time who thought they were pleasing God, but actually rejected God's Son and his people. But I think if we read between the lines here, we can understand what they were actually saying to the Philadelphians. And I think it goes something like this. God doesn't love you, he loves us. Your suffering and exclusion proves that God is on our side, not on yours. We follow Moses, we have the law of God, he loves us, he's on our side, he's not on your side, he doesn't love you. But Jesus says to his church, on the receiving end of rubbish like that, they will learn that I'm on your side and not theirs. They will learn that they are not of my house, but of the synagogue of Satan. They will learn defeat as I make them bow down before your feet. And above all, they will learn that I have loved you. Is there any doubt whose side Jesus is on? See, Philadelphia, you've been lied and slandered to and excluded, but there is a day when you will be vindicated. And I think this is significant encouragement because when we're wronged, we want vindication. We want justice. We want it publicly. We want people to see it. In our midweek groups, we've all adopted a persecuted church in the world, a fantastic initiative. Please, let's keep praying as we meet up on Wednesday nights for our particular adopted persecuted church. But just a quick show of hands, who has the church in Syria and Iraq? Okay, quite a few hands over there. Audrey Campbell, Shah, Ellie, great. How much do the Iraqi and Syrian Christians need to hear this encouragement right now? Excluded from religious life at the hand of ISIS? Excluded from just a mainstream, regular, easy life? Well, imagine if you can, that when Jesus returns, he says to the Iraqi and the Syrian Christians, actually, I'm on the side of ISIS, not you. Actually, you're going to learn defeat. This exclusion you're feeling right now, this is just the beginning. I'm on their side, not yours. And actually, I have loved them, not you. Wouldn't that be horrible? No, Jesus says to the Christians in Iraq, to the Christians in Syria, to the Christians in Philadelphia, to the ones in the offices, to the ones in the universities, to the ones at home, who are excluded for the name of Jesus, he said, I'm on your side and not on theirs. They will learn that they are wrong, and above all, they will learn that I have loved you. There is a day when you'll be vindicated. Does that strengthen you? Encouragement number three, the next trial won't touch you. Verse 10 says, because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial. I think this hour of trial, I think it refers to Jesus' final global judgment when he judges the world. I think verse 10 helps us to see that. Rather than being a local trial in Philadelphia, a final global judgment. Verse 10 again says, to try those who dwell on the earth. And that's a repeated expression you'll see right through Revelation. And it's always used in a judgment context. And so rather than being every human being on the planet, Christians and non-Christians, I think it refers to worldly people or people who aren't Christians, people who will be facing a final spiritual judgment from Jesus. And back when we looked at our church in Smyrna, Kev taught us a really interesting thing. He taught us that they were about to suffer. So look over the page if you can to chapter 2, verse 10. It says, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you'll have tribulation. And so we said it was a future suffering for Smyrna. But in today's passage, verse 8, chapter 3, verse 8, in Philadelphia, he says, you have kept my word and not denied my name. It seems to be a past trial for the Philadelphian church. Someone challenged me to put a Great British Bake Off reference in my talk, and so here it is. Take one's church in Smyrna, add a cup of tribulation and poverty and slander, add 2 cups of exclusion and sift the mixture within an inch of its life, and then bake it at a high temperature for 1 year to 18 months. We don't have that long, so here's one I prepared earlier. Here is a Philadelphian church. A powerless Philadelphian church. If the Smyrnans want to know what life is like in the future, they should ask their Philadelphian brothers and sisters. But Jesus promises Philadelphia, I will spare you from the hour of trial, where I will judge the world. See, he measures and limits the amount of suffering that his church faces. And this is encouraging, because when you're suffering, you don't want to hear that you've got a distant, powerless God. You want someone who knows you intimately, who controls your suffering. And he says, I've got my loving hand over you, and I will spare you from the only judgment that will really hurt you. And so think of the Christian worker whose boss and whole team around them are fierce atheists. They're the butt of every joke. Their boss treats them unfairly in favour of their colleagues. This continues at performance appraisal and salary negotiation time. Jesus says, I know you have a little power left. I know you're enduring these trials in the office, but I'll be sparing you from the truly terrifying trial, which we'll see later in Revelation. But your boss will not be spared. Encouragement number 4, as I said before, I'm going to combine that with point 5, the wait won't be long. It refers to Jesus coming soon from verse 11, but let's move straight to point 5. In all these churches in Revelation, there's a final climactic encouragement to every one of the churches, and so this is the one here for Philadelphia. The future dwelling is with God. Verse 12, the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. The picture language of the pillar in the temple is really significant. We started to read Psalm 84 at the beginning of our meeting tonight, and Kev talked about how even one day in God's house is better than 1,000 elsewhere. Better to be a doorkeeper in God's temple, because God lives there, than to be inside any other place. And the idea of a pillar, is a really important one. I was speaking to him during the week. Campbell's an architect, and he taught me this. He said, a pillar is structurally vital. It's load-bearing. It holds the roof up. It's a permanent fixture. It can't be moved. And so verse 12 speaks of an incredible reversal. Once outside the temple, now you are the temple. Do you see that? Once outside the temple, now you are the temple. God is so committed to having us in his temple. He doesn't just bring us in. He makes us part of the building itself. And he makes us the strongest, most permanent part. Verse 12 goes on. Never shall he go out of it. That's not some sort of punishment. Never shall he go out of Euston Church. People love going there. They could quite literally draw closer to God in the temple, because God was living there. Once locked out of the temple, now you don't ever have to leave, because you're part of it, permanently dwelling with God. Verse 12 goes on to talk about Jesus' love for tattoos. I've thought long and hard over the years about getting a tattoo. When I travel on the tubes, you see all these guys with sleeves and stuff, and I get all intimidated. And it's not the idea of the pain of the needle. Obviously, I'm quite tough, so the needle's fine. But it's the idea of permanence, so something on me forever, even when my skin is old and wrinkly. But it turns out permanence is exactly why Jesus loves tattoos. He says, I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes out of heaven, and my own new name. See, he wants to write on the Philadelphians. He wants to give them his own permanent special tattoo, something that will be seen by everyone. And this tattoo will have the name of God on it. Who do you belong to? The name of the New Jerusalem. Where do you belong? Were you born outside the UK? Have you ever had visa and passport issues? Jesus wants to tattoo us with a permanent visa. Included in my kingdom, it'll say. And finally, he wants to write on us his own new name, which we'll see further explained in Revelation. So there are the four or five doses of encouragement, of fuel. And just like any piece of medicine, any dose of medicine, we have to be careful how we take it. So we don't take cough medicine for a broken leg. So for some of us, we may have had a diagnosis like the church in Ephesus back in week one. That is, we forgot our first love because we're so busy with ministry and things like that. Others here, we could be like the churches in Thyatira, Pergamum and Sardis. That is, we had a sickness where we combined Christianity with some sort of worldly other sins. Well, you'll need the medicine of repenting. But some of you have been excluded and persecuted at university, in the workplace, maybe in the family. And your exclusion has left you emptied of strength and on your knees. And to you, Jesus says, I know you've been excluded and locked out. Well, I control the door to eternity. He says, I know you've been slandered, but your persecutors will learn that I have loved you and not them. I know that you've been facing many trials for my name, but I will spare you the ultimate trial when I come to judge the world. And finally, I know you are excluded and on the outside of a mainstream, easy life, but I am coming soon and you will be part of my temple where I will live forever. And so what does the faithful, enduring Christian have to do? Just hold on. I know you're on empty. Just hold on. Here is some fuel to fill your tank. Just hold on. He who has ears, let him hear.